You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Janaea Williams. Usually, lousy customer service is not a selling point for a restaurant, but here at the corner of Highland and Lexington in Hollywood, people are lining up for the chance to be yelled at by the waiters at Karen's Diner. Wendy Wilson Miller is waiting with her husband and two school-age sons.
I think it's just an area where very rude people talk to you. And we're allegedly going to have a meal, but that's questionable.
Karen's Diner is a one-weekend-only pop-up that's basically like sitting in the front row of a comedy show where you know you're going to be picked on by the performer. Customers come here to trade insults with the staff. Also, there's burgers. Why subject yourself to this, and who's doing the yelling? KCRW's Rebecca Ludman went to Karen's Diner to find out.
The rudeness starts as soon as you enter the door.
Yeah, we know you have a reservation.
Get on the other side.
The customers have no problem dishing it right back.
She says this is a service.
No, that's a service. No, that's what she said. No kidding. That is Karen Steiner, idiot. You pay for it.
For $60, restaurant customers play games, eat food, and of course, get picked on by the wait staff. The staff stay in character no matter what, which I found when I tried to interview Michael Rubin, the manager for the Karen's Diner LA pop-up.
And I'm talking in a dumb microphone for no reason because some dumb idiot goes, "How's it going?" Guys, but it's a radio show. I don't give a what?
While checking in, you're met with staff screaming at you to read the rules posted on the wall. Because yes, there are boundaries. Here's Robbie Alexander, who is in charge of hiring and training.
The rules look like no racism, no homophobia, no sexism, no sexual harassment, don't touch our staff, no body image comments, ableism, and no throwing food. Like, we're still a working restaurant.
Also, no aggressive behavior and no vandalism. That's how Alexander drew the lines when he opened the original Karen's Diner in Sydney, Australia, back in 2021. Since then, they have opened pop-ups from San Francisco to Calgary and permanent diners across Australia and the UK. Here at the LA location, Reuven has some additional guidelines.
The rules for today are you're going to be getting your food order, you are going to be eating your food, you are going to be leaving the largest tip ever because I have never seen someone who's so good at customer service like things as we are. And then you are going to get the out of my restaurant. Does everybody understand? Does everybody understand?
Karen's Diner has two CEOs. Their idea was to open a shocking restaurant experience that was also fun and filled with banter between waitstaff and customers. But why call it Karen's Diner? Well, the answer may not surprise you.
The traditional Karen went viral all over social media. They're like sort of usually middle-aged woman who has a problem in any restaurant or hospitality venue, and they love to voice it and make a scene.
The waiters here give terrible service, which brings out their customer's inner Karen. This being Hollywood and all, most of the waitstaff are actually actors. But getting hired here isn't a typical audition. A big part of the process is role play.
Being an actor doesn't make you like really good at improv or being really quick on your feet. It was the very quick-witted people that we searched for that just have that natural sense of humor.
Normally that's what they ask for.
Got it. Sparkling water.
A bougie water.
After she's seated at a table, Wilson Miller, who we met outside with her family, is nervous. Rightfully so, because she's been picked to play the first game. Essentially, she has 5 seconds to name three things in a specific category that Michael Rubin, the manager, chooses.
You right now, three reasons why you hate your kids. Go, 5, 4,
loud,
three,
and
two,
dirty, and
one.
Woo!
You heard that, right? I just want to make sure you're listening. Here, let me help you. Mommy doesn't like you.
Wilson Miller's kids just laugh at Rubin, along with everybody else in the restaurant. As people sit anxiously, hoping to not have to play the game, He announces it's time to order food.
And read your menu. There's three options, okay? Like, you don't know what you want. Go home. Like, actually. Thank you.
A look of relief flashes across everybody's face. No more game playing, just ordering. The choices are the basic Karen, Karen's got beef, and
the tree hugger with everything.
This is Wilson Miller's husband's order.
We have a vegan! Yay. We have a vegan! Let's all boo him! 1, 2, 3, boo!
The smell of burgers and fries fills the room. Customers take photos and videos of the treatment they're receiving, which you can find on our website. By the time food arrives, Wilson Miller is starting to worry about her son.
I think a little bit it's possible their kids bit off more than they can chew at Karen's Diner. It's a little, I'm questioning my parenting choices. But they're hanging in there. They're hanging in there. I think they're going to grow up a little today.
As the customers finish up their food, Reuben announces the final game. It's kind of like the Wheel of Fortune.
Here at Karen's Diner, we have a twist on that, and we call that the Wheel of Misfortune.
Reuben randomly picks people across the restaurant to go up and spin the wheel. The choices on the wheel are things like karaoke, dancing, gossiping, runway walks, and more. Anyone can be called on to play, even those who are sitting, maybe even hiding in the corner. About halfway through this game, the Wilson Miller family decides to head out early.
We're out.
We're out of here. This place sucks.
So do you, like, you weren't special. Get them out! Oh my God! Go!
It's all laughs and smiles as they walk out the door. From Alexander's perspective, the weekend pop-up was a big success.
It was really, really good. We got some really good response. And even to the point where, like, one of our Karens was loved so much that we ended up sending him over to Calgary to guide that tour.
And if you didn't get the chance to pay to be yelled at this time around, don't worry.
We have some more dates lined up in LA.
Their new dates haven't been announced yet, but will be posted on Instagram at Karen's Diner on tour. For KCRW, I'm Rebecca Ludman.
Coming up on Greater LA, we're going to talk with choreographer and director Benjamin Millepied about a performance of Romeo and Juliet's Suite that breaks all the rules. That's just ahead.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
More now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Janaea Williams. Romeo and Juliet, the story of two star-crossed lovers, has been playing out on stage and screen for centuries. But here in LA, Romeo and Juliet's Suite is taking place on stage and screen in a multimedia presentation by the LA Dance Project. Featuring a rotating cast of leads, the show is making its premiere this weekend at the Segerstrom Center for the Arts. With us today to talk about this new staging of Romeo and Juliet is LA Dance Project's artistic director, Benjamin Millepied. Benjamin, welcome.
Thank you.
So as I mentioned, people have been telling this story of Romeo and Juliet for years and years. So what made you want to put your own unique spin on it?
You know, I really had to find source of inspiration, and you know, especially because it's a really magnificent score, but it's been certainly choreographed a lot. Mm-hmm. And the way that it came to me was that I actually felt the music resonated more so to me as film music than stage music. Hmm. And so the first ideas that I started to have were actually to make a film, you know, Romeo and Juliet.
Okay.
And I started to, I actually shot a short film, which was the balcony scene set in LA with two actors, where the, you know, used the Shakespeare, and also there was dance, you know. So I, mm-hmm. that's how actually I first started to approach the idea to a cinema. And then because I've used video on stage for a long time, I started to think about, well, what if, you know, I use the camera as a tool live in front of, you know, the audience to actually portray these moments of drama that will feel much more visceral and realistic as cinema than they would on stage. You know, sometimes mm-hmm. I think, you know, when you're trying to tell a story through that on stage and there's drama and murder and violence and all kinds of things, it can be quite fake. Mm. And so, you know, the first time we did the first iteration of the piece was at Walt Disney Hall in Frank Gehry's magnificent building. And so that it was great because I could use spaces that the audience, right, isn't experiencing there in the hall, but take them to spaces off stage, you know. And the whole idea was, is nothing is recorded. It happens before the eyes of the audience. So the way the theater becomes a set, becomes a set for a murder, becomes a set for a dance, or for the, you know, dance of the nights. And so that's how I started to approach it. And we made this version for the first time with the LA Phil. And then I made a full version of the piece, which we premiered in September in Paris. So it's very, the idea is really like you go from watching a live performance to cinema in these very smooth transitions, but that feel magical because the camera is there on stage and it takes you off stage. And sometimes it, in some theaters, it takes you outside the theater even, you know. Mm-hmm. we go sometimes quite far because the environment is right for the scene. And so it's a very, you know, in that sense, the piece is quite unique. And I, you know, I just, it felt like that was an interesting take on it.
So the production has a rotating cast of leads. Sometimes it's a man and a woman, other times a man and a man, or a woman and a woman. So tell me about that choice.
Well, I felt like, you know, just because I'm telling a timeless, universal love story, mm-hmm. and what's my right to today decide that it has to be a man and a woman, and only a man and a woman? Mm. You know, I certainly felt like, well, we're representing this universal story of love, then it should also be, you know, two men or two women. I look at just my cast of dancers and, you know, the world we live in. Like, why would I not represent? I think it's quite beautiful in a way that this is one of the most famous love stories, and mm-hmm. let's have it represented by different forms of love.
I love that. So you mentioned that you first debuted a version of this in 2018. So how much has it changed since mm-hmm. then? I mean, it has a real focus on social issues. So was that something you wanted to highlight from the beginning, or did recent years bring more of that element into focus?
No, I think we did. We had a male cast in the first version at Walt Disney Hall. So again, like, yeah, it is, you're confronted with certainly a social issue, but it wasn't kind of my intention, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just mean like I'm really simply doing what I think is right. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, of course, it brings up conversation. There's people who aren't comfortable with it. And in Paris, it was interesting to hear whether, you know, men were dragged by their wives to see this piece and had no idea what to expect. And then they had, you know, two men on the street in this very intimate scene, a very tender scene, and, you know, weren't comfortable with it. Or kids who come with their parents and were quite thrilled with the fact that, you know, this is acceptable. And then it stirred a conversation with their parents. And, you know, it became part of conversation in Paris for the time that we were performing the show there. And it mm-hmm. was, and I think that's like a wonderful thing. And it was to my surprise, actually, how much it did bother some people, how hard it was for some people, you know. Mm-hmm. I think it just made sense to me to approach it this way.
So you're wearing so many hats these days. You recently directed another classic story, Carmen, for the screen. So what was it like to make that leap to the screen?
I mean, it was a continuation of my love for photography and film and dance films that I've made. And, you know, making a ballet in the studio, you really are, it's really an expression of yourself, of the music, of the people you have, you know, the interaction of people you have in front of you that inspire you. Mm. And it's a very freeing experience. And film, you know, especially with the script, I mean, it's like, you know, you also dive deep into yourself in a different way. And then there's all these amazing elements that I love, which were lighting and knowing where to put the camera and staging right. people on screen and creating an atmosphere that's kind of really connected to the score and all those things. So it was a pleasure to make my first film.
So what's next for you? What would you like to tackle next?
Well, I mean, I think we're delighted to be performing in Orange County in that beautiful hall for the first time. And, you know, the goal here is in LA really is to continue to build, it's just kind of to be a place of gathering for the dance community and the arts community, like continuing to perform more often in Los Angeles, to hopefully, extend our seating to more seatings, you know, more seats so we can have more shows with more people and more residences and strengthen our education program and really feel like we're bringing dance to Los Angeles with the work of all the choreographers that we present, but also be a place of resonance as much as we can for all the young talent in Los Angeles, so they have a place to create their work and present it, and we can offer visibility. So, you know, I of course I'd love to have more studios, and I would love to, you know, the more space we have, you know, the more we can offer, and really that's the goal here.
Benjamin Millepied from LA Dance Project, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me on the show. Really appreciate it.
The LA Dance Project will be performing Romeo and Juliet Suite for 3 nights only this weekend. If you'd like more information, head on over to our website, kcrw.com/GLA. Back now with more of GLA. I'm Janaea Williams. Everybody at every age has their own story to tell, but sometimes to get those stories out into the world, you might need a little help.
You know, my mother used to say, always look for the helpers. Anybody who is coming into a place where there's a tragedy.
Oh, baby, how do you
Because if you look for the helpers, you'll know that there's hope.
826LA is a nonprofit that helps kids aged 6 to 18 tell the stories they want to tell the way they want to tell them, whether that's through fiction, poetry, journalism, or even screenwriting. And sometimes they also help those students publish their stories so they can share them with the world, like they'll be doing later this week at a book fair and garden party called Changing the Story. Jaime Balboa is the executive director of 826LA, and he's here to tell us what they've been up to lately. Hey, Jaime.
Hey.
So give us some background. Where did 826LA originate, and how has it grown?
So 826LA started 18 years ago, but we got the 826 name from 826 Valencia, which was founded by Dave Eggers up in San Francisco. There's now a network of 826 chapters, and each one is its own nonprofit. 826LA works out of our writers' labs here in Echo Park and in Mar Vista and in three writers' rooms in Roosevelt High School, Venice High School, and Manual Arts High School.
What's the significance of 826?
So 826 was just the address of 826 Valencia Street. It started out small and scrappy
address.
And everyone thinking, you know, just go to 826 Valencia if you need tutoring and writing support. And from there, we grew to chapters all across the country.
Got it. So what are some of the different kinds of programs you offer for kids?
We have after-school programs, which provide tutoring and then writing support, college access programs where we help students write their essays for college applications.
Mm-hmm.
We do workshops with the Hammer Museum, and we also do field trips. So we bring in hundreds of students, or thousands of students throughout the year into our writing centers, and we provide field trips where they will write choose your own adventure story or some other kind of story and become published authors at the end of the day.
That's very cool. So writing creative stories is different from like writing an essay for school, right? That has to be factual and accurate. So what kind of stories do kids tell when they have the creative freedom to say whatever they want to say in a story?
Oh, they will tell you all kinds of things. They invent characters, space dragons or talking fruit, whatever the case may be. We walk them through the prompts of what's involved in a story. You have a protagonist, you have some characters that they interact with, you have a story arc and a conflict, and then a resolution. And so the students know to walk through that, and they can bring their imagination however they want to apply within those prompts.
Is there anything particularly creative that stands out that you've seen lately from a student?
I'm really excited about the poems that our students are going to be reading this Thursday at our garden party.
They wrote
a book. Some of the graduating students at Roosevelt High School wrote a book called The Art of Vulnerability, where they have written a number of poems. And those poems are just very powerful glimpses into the lives of students as they navigate high school, graduation, the pandemic, and everything that the world has been sort of throwing at us these past few years.
So obviously LA has a lot of creative people and writers living here. Are they the ones that are teaching the workshops?
Oh, yes. We have an army of volunteers. So this year we're on track to recruit 600 volunteers, to place 600 volunteers. But they really come from all walks of life. So you could be a writer in your day job, or you could be just someone who loves students. And we will train you. We offer trainings for our volunteers, and then place them with the age groups that they most feel comfortable working with.
And so you mentioned that kids get to publish their work, and you also mentioned your upcoming garden party and book fair. So what kinds of things can people see there?
So we will have on display a number of student publications. So we publish literally hundreds of books. Some of them are zines. Others are more perfect bound books that the students publish. And those will be on display at the book fair for people to see.
Mm-hmm.
But then also our students will be reading live poetry. So it will really be a nice display of everything that we do at A26LA to support our students and their teachers.
And where will the funds from the fundraiser go?
The funds support us. We are a nonprofit, so we are working with 155 teachers this year. We're working with over 5,000 students this year, and we raise the money every year to be able to do this, to be able to train the volunteers, to place them, to publish the books. So all of the funds will support our ongoing operations.
All right. Jaime Balboa is the executive director of 826LA. You can find more information on volunteering with the group and the book fair at kcrw.com/GLA. Thanks, Jaime.
Thank you.
That's all for today. Tomorrow, what you and the experts have to say about making friends in LA. Spoiler alert, it's really not that easy. And a show later this week devoted to the LA theater scene, including a local indigenous playwright who has her latest play on Broadway, and a new generation of Asian American theater. That's all coming up this week on GLA. Tell us what's on your mind, share a story idea with us, and get the podcast. It's easy. Just go to kcrw.com/GLA or get the podcast wherever you get them by searching KCRW Greater LA. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthews, Sonia Geis, John Meek, Phil Richards, Michael Stark, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, and Christian Bordal all helped put the show together today. I'm Janaea Williams. Thank you so much for your time and have a great night.